Hello and welcome to a very special episode of Room 404. I'm your janitor, Ewan Spence, and 7 weeks ago when I thought this would be a really neat one-shot joke idea for beta, little did I think that we would be recording one show 7 weeks later, live in Austin, with my guest opposite me here in the table in the depths of the American Room 404, commonly known as the last dying hours of breath of South by Southwest Interactive. For those of you who have not listened before, Room 404 is simple. It is the room where everything that you forgot about is in here. If I look to my left, I find the delightfully scary game of Stop the Terrible Tank. If I look around the corner, I have Jeffrey Archer's career. And there, lurking in the corner, I have Adam Curry's claims to be the man who invented podcasting. Joining me now in Room 404, a very famous technology guest who's looking to bring four of his old favourite things back out of Room 404 from the depths of his memory back into society. And for karmic balance purposes, attempting to put one thing as well. Joining me now, I have the man who invented podcasting. It's Kevin Marks.
Hi there. Great to see you again, Ewan.
It is, yes. And it's the first time somebody can actually say that on Room 404. Let's clear up a point first, though. Did you invent podcasting?
I didn't invent podcasting, but I did invent downloading audio from blogs into iPods.
Yes, it's Ben Hammersley actually invented the word.
Yes, but it was Dave Weiner who came up with the idea of attaching audio files to RSS feeds.
It really is this long, complicated historical thing, isn't
it? It's a silly, very long and silly argument.
Yes, and we're British. We like long and silly arguments.
Well, I've been in America for 14 years now. It's sort of the novelty is expired.
Starting to wear off. So you've got an impressive list of, for want of a better word, geek credentials here from the early internet days, haven't you?
I'm not sure about that. I mean, I've been hacking on computers for, let's see, since 1978. I can't actually do the maths in my head, but the first thing I wrote for the computer was a program for the Commodore PET that I sold to help someone sell fax machines by calculating how much cheaper they were than sending letters.
And on from there, and various bits of streaming media and tech and IP and voice. And a lot of it built around media, even from that first program. I'm sure, I don't think you've ever told me that story before. Everything to do with moving one thing from one place to another efficiently.
I suppose that's true. I mean, the first startup I did was when we left the BBC and started Multimedia Corporation in 1990, and our goal there was to make computers do video. We had a slight problem is that computers were not capable of doing video at this point, so we had to attach external devices and control them through serial ports to do video instead of digitizing video and putting them up on the screen. But a few years later, some helpful people at Apple invented QuickTime, we were able to start doing video, and that was good.
Yeah, because so we're going to rattle through this one. Those of you who have not been at the South by Southwest Interactive Festival before, it's 4 or 5 days where about 20,000 smart people descend on one conference centre to learn from each other, to party with each other, to exchange tips and show off their new applications and new wares. So time is scarce. So Kevin, thank you for sparing the time today.
Not at all.
We have four items to come out, one to go in. We're going to rattle through these slightly quicker than normal, which is good because this is meant to be a 20-minute show that usually goes 50. We've only got 25 minutes of capacity left on the mini disc, so what's going to be joining my bit of old technology potentially?
So one thing I really miss is rootable IP addresses.
I mean, this is so far in depth and nerdy, and let's explain it for the more casual person who just goes, what is that, like where I put in my phone orange.wap?
So the IP address is the unique number that your computer has to send information over the internet and to receive it back again. And the problem is we've run out of them this year. There are potentially not quite 4 billion of them, and we've allocated that many already. What this means is when your computer now needs to route information over the internet, it doesn't have a real IP address. It borrows one from somebody else and has a made-up one for the first leg of the journey. And that makes it very hard for information to be served from you rather than for you to fetch from the internet. And this is a problem. Tim Berners-Lee could not have invented the web in the first place without rootable IP addresses. He happened to have a computer on his desk connected to the internet, and he said, oh, what if I, instead of having these IP addresses, what if I changed these text strings into IP addresses and connected that over the net so that we can move information back and forth? And he built a web server on his own machine, and he worked a web browser on his own machine, but the web browser worked on somebody else's machine and see his machine, and it worked. Now we don't have this. Most of the time, we're sitting with a computer or a phone connected to somebody else's Wi-Fi with a fake IP address. We can't run servers. All we can do is be clients. And this is a problem. This means it makes it hard for us to come up with new protocols and new ideas to connect stuff across the net. And we end up routing everything through web pages and having a big distinction between stuff that's on our own machines and stuff that's out there on the web. Whereas before, the stuff that was on your own machine could be out there on the web.
Well, this is really something to try and boost the hacker culture, because it is possible to get a rootable IP address depending on if you're at university or if you're on a specialist hosting company. But somebody who's on, say, Virgin dial-up in the UK, they're going to have problems, aren't they?
Yes. The other part of this is that most of the ISPs will potentially sell you a rootable IP address, but they charge you a lot for it, because that's a business thing. And if you've just got a home service, they may even block some of the packets and the possibility of getting stuff to you. So that can be a problem too. So there's this potential problem that means that it may be harder for us to come up with new protocols and stuff in the future because we've got to divide the world into clients and servers.
So let me ask a technical question now, because what we're talking about of running out of IP addresses is called IP version 4. We're now coming on, fingers crossed, in the next year or two, to IP version 6. Does this give us enough numbers to have rootable IPs then?
Yes. If we adopt IPv6, we've got enough rootable IP addresses to give one to approximately half the atoms on Earth. So that should be enough for the foreseeable future. So we could all have multiple things in our pockets that do root, but this means the internet companies changing their infrastructure to deal with IPv6 as well as IPv4, and all the software. The software in the clients is mostly there, but we need to actually do big infrastructure modifications to make that work. So I'm hoping that does happen.
Now, I mean, there's lots of stuff going on right here in South by Southwest. This is the best studio we can find. It's next to some cellophane pillars. But now, here's the thing. I'm not actually sure that rootable IP addresses are actually in room 404 and forgotten about. I think they're there and available if people need them. And yet I agree with you that the home users don't know about it. But my question isn't, should we bring them out? It's my question is, are they actually in there at the moment?
In practical terms, they are. So, okay, I'll say rootable IP addresses by default. Is that better?
That's better, I think, yes.
Okay.
That can come out, because I think everybody should be able to make their own media and push it out to everybody else. I can't think why.
Especially when it's your podcast, yes.
Yeah, I mean, I was leaving that as an ironic pause, but there we go. Right then, item number two, Kevin.
So item number two that I want back is my Commodore PET backups tapes. So my first computer was a Commodore PET. I got it in 1979 after I'd written this program and convinced my dad that I could do something interesting with it. He lent me the money to buy it, and I paid it back out of doing a paper round for a year.
For a year?
Yeah.
Now, let me just get it right. You're not arguing for the Commodore PET to come back out. You're not asking for lots of backing tapes to come out. You're asking for one thing of yours to come back out.
Well, what happened is when I moved to America, I left all that in my mum's garage, and she very carefully preserved the computer and threw out all the tapes. So I've got this nice old bit of hardware from the late 70s, but unfortunately all the data I created in that time has been disposed of. So that's what I'd like back.
Oh, I mean, that is... What else is on the tapes? I mean, you've got the fax program. What else?
It's a mixture of, like, me trying to write video games in BASIC, and then me learning assembler and writing video games in assembler, and then... there was a bunch of my mates who built a programmable character generator so that you could change the typeface on the screen from just being the classic one to something else. A bunch of stuff I wrote for that. There's like lots of bits and pieces. No, I'd just like to go back and have a look at it. And there are emulators around now that I could run them on. And, you know, I could probably run one on my phone. But it's just the data has gone, and that's a problem.
And it's a problem all told, because even if we had the tapes back now, magnetic tape from the late 70s is... going to be cutting it fine, isn't it? What's the
magnetic
length of time?
Not bad. Audio cassette tape from the 70s will still play, and it wasn't that high bit rate, so
I suppose there's quite a big tolerance there, and I can still listen to.
But I'd probably have to find. I will bet money that if I went and looked on the net, I could find something that would turn an MP3 of a PET cassette tape into a binary for image that would go into my PET, into a PET emulator. So,
well, I do know they exist for the spectrums, but when you plug in the back and everything, or of course, what you could do now, and this is one I've seen, is somebody had got all their Commodore, their Spectrum tapes, because Commodore tapes are only good for burning, And this is Commodore PET, not Commodore 64, so that's okay. And they'd taken all, and they'd basically MP3'd all the Spectrum tracks and put them on their iPod as MP3s. So it still took 4 minutes to load the tape games in. You just plugged it into the back of an actual Spectrum, press play on the iPhone.
That's wonderful. That's a splendid piece of applied technology. I like that idea, yeah.
You like that idea? Right, tell you what, you can have the tapes out, but only as MP3s that you have to play back yourself.
Okay.
You know, so, get the Commodore PET, put the cable in. Yeah. I'll give you a bundle of... Yes. That's the deal. You get them out as MP3s.
Okay, I can cope with that.
I can cope with that as well.
I can write some audio processing software and get them back if I do that.
That's not the point. No, you've got to keep them as MP3s.
Oh, okay then.
If you want memories of your youth back, you have to have all the memories.
I've got an old iPod Shuffle lying around. I could put them on. Yeah.
There we go. That's good. Because you wouldn't know what you're loading then, would you?
Right. Well, actually, I've had something like that happen with my Android, which is that... my voicemails are recorded onto there as MP3s, and then my music player finds them, and when I'm on shuffle, every now and then it will play a random voicemail from like 3 months ago.
Only at South by Southwest. Right then, you're doing quite well. You've got two out in kind of a fashion.
Some variant of.
Everybody's now thinking we should try and get our stuff out in person. It's obviously harder. Let's see how we get on with item three.
So item three, I want Mornington Crescent servers to come back.
Done. Item four.
Okay.
Right then, for those people who are listening, let's just illustrate what we mean with two people, okay? Because then we can go talk about the service. So, Dollis Hill,
Neeson Park.
Oh, are we playing pre-1964 or not?
I was going for present day. Is that?
Oh, yeah. Okay. In that case,
can we make it 1998? Because I can't remember the new Jubilee line.
You can do, but then you can't have Neeson Park because we're above and we're on a +3 coefficient.
You're right. Okay. Preston Hill.
Preston Hill. Ooh, Grange Hill.
Orange Hill.
Ah, Belfast.
Transporter Bridge.
Ooh. You put me in nip.
I did.
Swine. No, I can't do that. No. Only Tottenham Court Road's open.
Oh, hang on. Damn.
+3 coefficient, remember?
Yes. Bank.
Now, we're not playing the weakest link here, folks. So, +3 coefficient in NIP takes two off. Bank's above the Thames. Oh, if I go below the Thames, force you west. Vauxhall.
Oh no, hang on. I said 98, so I can't go through the East London line. Damn. I'm boxed. I'm gonna... Oh, no. I can't.
You're going to Kensington, aren't you?
Yes. High Street, Kensington.
Mornington Crescent.
Well done.
So, why do you want to bring back a Mornington Crescent server, the quintessential British radio game?
Well, there was a web version of this radio game that a bunch of people set up by having the simplest Perl script on earth, which basically gave you two fields to type into and it would append it to the page. The first field you put your name in, the second thing you put your move in, and you will alternate and play Mornington Crescent, like we just did, but with text. Except that it was multiplayer, it was on servers, and you'd make a couple of moves a day and it would happen over time. And then people would use it to play other games. They'd play the Limerick game, they'd play... You can't play one tune to the song of another because it's text, but you can play many of these other games. You could play... Face Pajamas. Do you remember Face Pajamas?
Yeah, they had Cheddar Gorge as well.
Yeah. They had... Basically, it was anything, any sort of improv comedy you can do with speech, you can do with text. It's a little bit more work with text, but it can work. And the closest thing we've got to this now is the sort of weird Twitter hashtag games. That's almost Mornington Crescent Service Reborn, but it doesn't have the same threading and ability to make multiple rooms.
Yeah, and repetition and all of that stuff, because the order is just as important. Right.
And then the wonderful Jos Graham used to run Mornington Crescent Servers too. So
Jos, of course, who we had back a couple of weeks ago as well. Wow. So maybe, Jos, if you're listening, you know, Starship Titanic's ticking over, maybe you could carve out a little space in the games room.
That would be fun.
It would be, yeah. Well, as we already said at the top, Mornington Crescent Servers are out. No, it's a given. 3 for 3.
I'm doing well.
I mean, we might as well call you Tim Lincinum.
I'm not sure about that. I have no idea that is. Sorry, I've been away. I mean,
that's fine. He's I was putting in. I was doing my weekly American baseball reference.
Oh, I thought it was okay. No, American baseball I don't follow at all.
Oh, an opening picture for the anyway. Item 4
makes no sense. Okay, item 4 is Groggs. That's spelled Groggs.
Groggs. Ah,
you have no idea, do you?
No, I'm bluffing.
It's the Generalized Reverse Order Gossip Gathering System, which was on the computer system at Cambridge University when I went there in the mid-80s. And it was kind of a chat room type, Twitter type thing. It was slightly threaded. If you had an account on the computer, you could log into this thing and you'd see the new threads and you'd post to them and reply to them. So it was kind of like Usenet, except it was very local, mm-hmm. and so you had much more of a sense of who the people were. And I used this for 3 years when I was at Cambridge and had lots of fun playing with it and inviting people to the film club and debating this and that. And I think it would be nice to have it back. I did actually go and look for it when you mentioned this idea, and I found there is an archive of it. But very thoughtfully, they only give you access to the archive if you can prove you were a member.
Oh, so that's nice. That's like TARDIS up at Edinburgh University as well. TARDIS ICUC. It's TARDIS Ed ICUC. Apologies. Don't want to give you the real address. I might look it up now.
So I and it's probably cheating a bit because the archives are actually available, and I did download them and lose an entire night reading them. But it was the service itself that was there that worked, and it was you know, it goes back to the first one. It was a small service that was written by somebody that could run locally over the machines. We could use it. It was fun. It makes sense, and it didn't involve storing all this stuff on some other company's server so they could sell ads against it. It was just running on the Cambridge University mainframe, I suppose. So it was the university could run ads against us or something. But.
So how big was the archive?
Not very big at all. It didn't. Yeah, I can't remember how long it was. Like,
I mean, with megs, gigs,
megs. It was tiny.
So basically, you could carry it around on your phone now.
That's true.
You just need to write a client.
Well, this is the thing about archives. This was the thing that blew my mind when I got the multi-arcade machine emulator, was that most of the games that I remember from the 80s and 90s took up less space than their icons. Yeah. They were like 17K, and you go, oh, download that. Did that happen? And then, yeah, this interesting thing is that it feels like you can't get much on your phone, because instead of having a hard disk, you've got flash storage, and that's more expensive per gig. Yeah. But actually, you can probably get everything you did with a computer before 1995 on your phone in the space that you'd have one voicemail message.
I actually checked this out a while back, which was, how big is the archive of every single ZX Spectrum game? Now, there are two things missing. There's about 100 games in total missing off the official archive. And Codemasters has said, please don't copy off any of our games. So they exist, but they're not on the servers. Everything, yeah, with as an image, is about 370 meg.
Right, very plausible. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. So exactly. Now, what are you arguing to get out here? Are you arguing to get the archive out, the reader out, the service out? I'm not quite sure on that though.
I think the service out. I think there isn't any real reason to stop running these kinds of services. And you could certainly, you know, this was a terminal thing. You could certainly map it to the web. You could map it to Twitter or email or something else, have different affordance into it. But having these local things is very attractive.
Yes. See, this is, again, another interesting one for me. Because, to me, again, you're arguing for something that is probably already out here. There's lots of services that are very similar to this. It's not a specific one. And, you know, it's chats, it's threads, it's a little bit of this, a little bit of that, a little bit of Monica, a little bit of Erica, all of that. And it doesn't feel like it's particularly unique. Yes, the content is and the people is, but to actually bring out the grogs, you know, service back out again. You know, twofold. One, I think that there's so many opportunities to create communities now with the great tools that you would be able to easily replicate this yourself. And if you had a code monkey, you'd be able to do it quite quickly. And
there is that.
And, you know, it would be a great startup idea. And it also, and don't take this the wrong way, but everybody has it too easy nowadays when you can just download PHP BB and body press and just away they go. I don't want to hand them everything on a silver platter. They should, you know, I shall make you a deal on this one, okay? And there's going to be a lot of responsibility in this, okay? You can have grogs out, but you have to delete every vBulletin installation in the world first.
Ah. Okay, that seems like a win, actually. This is a win for the world, isn't it?
You going for that, then?
Yep.
Right, okay, so if you can come back in the Christmas special and prove to me that you've deleted all the vBulletin episodes, then grogs can come out.
Okay.
For now, it moves into 301, which is our purgatory.
Purgatory, okay.
So we might redirect, we might not.
Okay.
So, 3 out of 4.
That's actually 302.
Is that 302? What's 301?
301 is permanently redirected.
Well, it was in 404. We've moved it up. It's there. We might move it again. Thing is, you're now arguing with the host.
Again, it should be a 302.
302, 301. I've said 301 in previous episodes, though, so we have to keep the joke running.
Oh, okay, then.
Yeah, otherwise I'll look silly. Again.
Do people know how you dress?
No, it's audio. I'm audio.
So I wouldn't worry about looking silly.
Okay, thank you very much, then. Right, 304 coming out. Karmic balance time.
Okay.
Bringing in something from the modern world. Now, just to stress something here, this is a global thing. Okay, you can't just put in something cute on my phone. Something that goes in, you have ripples.
That's right.
Okay, so, Kevin, what are you banishing?
I'm banishing two big buffers.
Now, being British, with a British sense of humour, that could refer to a great many things.
I'm surprised you didn't say matron, actually.
I was just taking it easy, you know. We do not have any daffodils at the table.
Well, two big buffers. And that's T-double-O, two big buffers, not two big buffers. We have a problem, which is, it's a problem of abundance. It's actually really, really easy to get RAM now. Anyway, I was joking about it earlier with the Spectrums and the pets and the video games. But now it's very, very easy to just stick RAM in something. And that means it's very easy just to add buffers to things so that you can cope with variation and jitter and unpredictability. And so it's you're an engineer, you think, oh, that's a nice, easy solution. I'll add a buffer to this. But the problem is every time you add a buffer, you're adding delay. And there are lots of places where this happens and it causes problems. One place is audio and telephony. One of the reasons your phone, your cell phone, is so much more annoying than your landline is that it's got extra audio buffers in it. It's got an audio buffer as it goes in when you're speaking to it. It then compresses that audio. It writes it into, sends it over the network, goes through some network buffers. It comes out into buffers on the other end of the phone, and they add a little bit more delay there. Then it goes into the codec and gets buffered in and get buffered out again. So by the time it's done all that, you've got like half a second to a second of lag before you've even routed it over the internet. So from something that could potentially be running at the speed of light and not be that noticeable delay has now got this extra delay that makes it fairly hard to talk and record. You have the same problem with lots of audio gear. When you start using computers for audio, it just starts getting easier to put buffers in, and that adds delay. It makes it very hard to use them for mixing. If you look at a TV, modern TV sets have multiple frame buffers because they're doing clever image processing to get rid of interlaced artifacts, do stuff like that. So when you inject a video signal into the TV, it takes four frames before you see it, which means you've then got to delay the audio four frames as well, and suddenly you've got another audio buffer, and then you're trying to play your video games going, why is my really expensive LCD display worse than this CRT that I had before? Why is everything suddenly laggy? Oh, because everything's got a bunch of buffers added. But the one that's really annoying is the two big buffers that people throw into internet infrastructure. Because it seems like a good idea. It's like, oh, if I'm sending data over the internet, if the thing the other side of it is a bit slow, if I keep buffer it up, I can send it through a bit later, and that will save dropping packets and having to retransmit them. And the problem with this theory is that internet, the TCP IP protocol is designed to cope with drop packets and to discover the point at which the network drops packets to see how fast it is. And so if you start putting buffers in, you actually break TCP IP. So you start sending bits into the network, and TCP goes, oh, they're accepting it. Great, I'll go a bit faster. They're accepting it. I'll go a bit faster. Because it's trying to find the point where it says, no, the buffer's full, stop it. And it goes backs up a bit below that so it can send it through as fast as possible. And what happens is it's filling up in this one of these buffers in the system somewhere. It's not actually measuring the whole delay from one end to the other. And so your thing throws all this data into there. It doesn't actually get sent. It sits there, and then eventually it realizes it's delayed, and then it starts messing about with the bandwidth, and you find that you can't, you know, watch streaming video over the net, or suddenly your game gets jittery or something like that happens, because it's the protocol is trying to discover what the actual end-to-end speed of light type delay is, but something in the middle doesn't belong to you, is sitting there adding an extra delay, and making it very hard for you to do anything that's actually interactive with your system, like play a video game, have a telephone conversation, send video over the net, those kinds of things. So I say get rid of those buffers.
It strikes me that buffers on the internet, from how you described it there, is the ultimate illustration of capitalism.
Well, go on.
Because if it was communism, you know, everybody gives what they can, everybody takes what they can, then you would need buffers, because you'd be just giving out as fast as you can, and people would be accepting as fast as they can, and nothing more. And so, in other words,
I'm not seeing a metaphor here.
Oh, okay, maybe we're not seeing a metaphor. Let's try again then, shall we? Right, capitalism, you just buy, spend as much as you can to your own personal needs. In other words, you're quite greedy about it. Communism, you know, everybody's providing what they can, and it benefits the greater good. So, if you got rid of buffers, then everybody would accept as fast as they can, and everybody would give as fast as they can, and then the TTIP would be the regulator, as it were. It would be the Politburo.
Okay, if you want to do a financial metaphor, it would be debt. Buffers are latency debt. So if you've got some kind of credit card that will keep letting you borrow money, you don't notice that you've run out, and then you suddenly find you've got to pay back all that debt that you've accumulated, and that takes longer than it would have done to do it in the first place. So buffers are the debt crisis of the internet.
Ah, see, now we're getting somewhere. Now we're getting something interesting, because I like that. I like the idea, because I'm one of the people that I like my credit card clear. I like paying it off at the end of every month, and then I don't have stuff. So what you're essentially saying is if we got rid of buffers, everybody would be in a much more sensible footing.
Yes.
What's the downside? Because you must know if there's a downside or not.
Well, the downside is if you're... The trade-off is that you're trading off latency for bandwidth when you're doing this. So if you have fewer buffers, you're getting the latency back, but you're seeing more jitter in your bandwidth. And the idea of buffers is to smooth that out. So if you're just doing a one-way file transfer and you're not bothered when it's done, then a buffer may help you a bit because you don't get any drop packets. But if you're actually using the internet interactively or the problem... See, there's a big difference between bandwidth and latency. Bandwidth is how much you can move through, and latency is how long it takes. You can always get more bandwidth by buying more cables and connecting them together, but you can never get any latency back that you've lost, because once you've delayed it, you can't go backwards in time and get it back again, unless you've got a TARDIS in the network somewhere.
Yeah, which is still up at Edinburgh University, and you can only go there if you've proved you've been to Edinburgh.
Fair, I have been to Edinburgh, but only on the train.
So there we go. It's such a fundamental change to the structure of the internet you're asking for here, Kevin, isn't it?
No. What I'm saying is this is how the internet was designed. When the internet was put together, we didn't have enough RAM to make these giant buffers, so the thing would hold like 3 packets, 4 packets at most. Whereas now it can hold, you know, all the Spectrum games ever made.
What you're asking for then is for the internet designers to turn it off and on again.
There you go.
There you go. And whenever that phrase, turn it off and on again, is used in room 404,
what happens?
We are happy.
We're happy.
Okay. We're happy. Bye-bye, big buffers. In it goes. See, if I was back in the studio, we could do a really cute sound effect there. But
excellent.
We don't. We just have to imagine the really cute sound effect.
You can always do them in post.
No, because music starts tomorrow at South By, and I'll be busy.
I see.
I've got to try and interview Duran Duran.
Are you going to get them to do Room 404?
I'd love to. Personally, I just want to go up to them and go, so, how shit were Spandau Ballet?
Well, have you been following Simon Le Bon's tweets?
No, I haven't, no.
Yeah, Simon Le Bon is tweeting as Simon J.C. Le Bon. It's definitely worth it.
Does he follow
if he's around.
Does he follow the Kemp brothers?
Yeah, I think one of them. I think
just one of them. That must be really galling.
Cross-check the all the followings yet. But.
So there we go. Room 404 exclusively revealing that Simon Le Bon might be following Spandau Ballet on Twitter. What would you do without the show? You'd probably have 32 minutes of your life back, if I was honest. Kevin, big buffers, banished forever. Grogs, sitting in 301.5. Three others successfully out. That is a good run at 404. Are you happy with that?
I think so. I think I'm pleased that that came out that way.
Okay, so, Kevin, you can be found online in many places, both in the written word, spoken and in video as well. Where can people keep an eye on you and find out more?
I'm Kevin Marks on pretty much everything you can type a name into, like Twitter and MySpace and Facebook and so on. KevinMarks.com, and my podcast show that I do weekly... on Thursdays at 6 p.m. Pacific, which is small hours of the morning in England, is tamilvision.tv. That's TUMMELVISION.TV.
Kevin, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Ewan.
And for all of you listening out there, Room 404 will be back again next week, because to be honest, it was touch and go whether it was going to get an episode this week. You'll find us on iTunes under Room 404 and online to find your comments in the RSS feed at room404.thepodcastcorner.com. Want to get in touch with me, want to be on the show, suggest some guests, or if you're the other Kemp follower who's not the other Kemp follower, I need beer. I was going to say the other Kemp brother who's not being followed, but yeah, get in touch, Ewan at thepodcastcorner.com. Camp follower. No, we're not doing Eurovision yet. That's in May. Okay? Cheers. Catch you next week.